Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. These words were spoken by Carl Sagan and were inspired by the pale blue dot, a picture of Earth taken by the Voyager 1 space probe from a distance of 6 billion kilometers or 3.7 billion miles. In the spirit of that insight, I asked today's guest, Rabbi Akiva Gersh, also known as the Vegan Rabbi, why does God not intervene to stop the horrors of animal exploitation? That kicked off a fascinating conversation about religion and its place in the vegan movement, the nature of evil, anti-Semitism, and why does Rabbi Akiva think that the fight for animal rights is a holy fight? I am full of admiration for Rabbi Akiva's tireless work of using religious arguments to promote compassion for animals in the Jewish community. Connect with him on Instagram at @veganrabbi or visit his website akivagersh.com. Link in the episode's notes. There's this big problem that we are all aware of in the vegan community, which is animal exploitation. In terms of scale, you know, the scale of this horror, it's, you know, unimaginable. There isn't something comparable to, you know, think about the billions of animals and the way they are kept in captivity and then also tortured and killed. So, it's just the beyond, it's a category of its own, this type of horror. But then, you know, in religious communities, and, you know, I consider myself a religious person, we believe in all sorts of supernatural beings, starting with God, you know, capital G, but also God, you know, small g, angels, spirits, the list goes on. And sometimes, you know, I ask myself, what are they up to? Why are they not intervening? Why is heaven, God, whatever, not doing something about this horror that is unfolding? And of course, I can hear, you know, the skeptics say, because they don't exist. That's why they're not intervening. But what do you make of that question?
Really powerful question. It's a really good question. And I'll say, please, God, help me with my answer in answering that question. As a Jew and in Judaism, we believe and we teach the very important place of free will, free choice. And God created this world, and God created creation, and God created all these creations and this wonderful, magnificent, beautiful, gorgeous, wonderful world that we live in, and gave humans free choice. And that was both the best idea, and I think you can even say the worst idea on some level, with all due love and respect to God, of course, right? I mean, it was God, in God's wisdom, God gave us free choice, but God knew. I mean, it's part of the Jewish tradition, I imagine other religious, spiritual traditions as well, that God knew with free choice, anything can happen. There's even an oral teaching. There's a teaching in the Jewish oral tradition that says that before humans were created, that the angels, basically God asked the angels about creating humans, you know, as this different kind of creation, and the angels were against it. The angels were actually against it because of what possibly could happen as a result of us being in the world and with our free will, and God created us anyway. So there is great risk in creating a being with free choice. But, you know, to answer your question, I feel like it all comes down to that God felt that it was very important that there be one creature in this world, that being the human beings, with free choice. Because with free choice can come incredible and magnificent things. But of course, unfortunately, the opposite can be true as well. So, right, you know, we're always, you know, maybe not always, but often whenever there are moments of great challenge and suffering and tragedy, we're like, where is God? Why doesn't this be a perfect time for God to intervene and save the day, you know, come down and swoop down and save the day, like some, you know, magnificent movie scene where all the evil, you know, people or doers just get wiped out and good, you know, prevails. That's not the kind of world that God created. God created a world where humans are in the world with free will and with free choice. And with that comes great responsibility. And we are meant to. I mean, the teachings of Judaism and other traditions as well are filled with moral and ethical teachings to teach us and to show us and to guide us how to use that responsibility and how to use that free choice in the best possible way. Unfortunately, we, the human beings, have not always made the best choices. Sometimes we've made horrible choices, and we continue to make horrible choices. And for some reason, we are okay doing things that cause such great suffering and pain to other humans and to other creatures. And so God's, you know, God's role here is not to swoop down and save the day. God wants us to do it. We're the ones who are supposed to live the right way. And if we don't live the right way, then to make the corrections and to make the fixings in order to make this world a better place. It's on our shoulders and our shoulders alone. And so, yeah, it's painful for anyone who's sensitive and aware to see the suffering happening in the world, and we want it to be over in a second. Of course, we don't care how it ends. We just want it to be over. But this is the world where, you know, humans were created and humans have free will, and we're meant to use our free will to solve the problems that, let's be honest, we created ourselves. And so sometimes, unfortunately, it takes a while for us to find the solutions or to, you know, convince people to use the solutions that have already been found, especially in the case of, you know, how we eat and the food choices that we make.
Is there a place in Judaism for evil, you know, for the belief that there is like a devil or something, something demonic? I often attribute, you know, or let me put it this way. If there was an evil, I guess the closest thing to it would be animal exploitation. So is there a place for that in Judaism?
Like, there's a lot has been written about evil, good and evil, again, connected to human free will, over the thousands of years that Judaism has been an organized and existing religion. In Judaism, we talk about something called the Yetzer Hara, which is the evil inclination. Okay, first of all, as you know, as a monotheistic path, we believe that there's one force, only one force, everything's from God. God's the only force that created and maintains everything in the world, right? So that, of course, brings up the big philosophical question that was related to your question before, like, how can there be evil in a world that was created by an all-loving and all-good God? But there is a place for evil because of free will, right? Free choice gives birth to the possibility of humans choosing the opposite of good, okay? And we see that, and while we don't have this belief of any spiritual force really being against God, because everything's on God's side, everything's within the realm of God, when it comes down to this world, this physical world that we're in, yes, we the humans do have the possibility of choosing evil. We do have this inner kind of battle between us, between good and evil. We have this evil inclination, and that could, if acted upon, that can come out in all different kinds of ways. You know, selfishness, lack of compassion, and greed, stealing, lying, and the like. And unfortunately, humans have and continue to choose that path of selfishness. And when we look at animal exploitation, you know, I think there's a lot of things that lead to that. There's a lot of factors, but I think one very strong factor is one, selfishness, just focusing on myself. I don't care. I just like to taste, and I want it to be cheap, and I want it to be readily available, you know, and not thinking about it, not even caring about what happens behind the scenes, you know, before the animal is turned into a, you know, a piece of food wrapped in plastic and sold in the supermarkets. I think it's also, in addition to selfishness, it's just it's a, I want to say an inability, but maybe a better way to say it is not yet tapped into ability to feel the pain and suffering of others, whether those others be humans or non-human creatures in this world. And I think also in there, and I've heard this, is the absurd belief that animals can't feel pain and suffering like we humans can. So I think it's also ignorance. It's a lot of different factors, but all those things that I just mentioned are rooted in evil, in using free will to choose the evil path and the evil side, and the one that's not compassionate, that's not loving, and that's not seeking to bring goodness and justice into the world.
Fighting this evil is not an easy business. And you know, I've had so many, I've talked to so many activists who have felt, you know, burned out and tired and depressed from doing the work of advancing, you know, the vegan cause and being pro-animal. Is there any teaching in Judaism that helps us, you know, deal with that, with being face to that evil and fighting that evil, you know, as a weapon for our well-being and you know, safeguarding our sanity in this fight?
Right, which is so important. It's so important, in order not to get burnt out, so that we can continue to do this very important, and I even call it holy work. Judaism says a lot about this. You know, Judaism, when you look, when you go deep, when you go deep, when you go deep, Judaism at its core, I think we can say, is an activist movement. It's an activist movement. It's why. What is an activist movement? An activist movement or activist organization is focused on something that's wrong in the world or broken in the world, and they want to fix it. They want to solve it. They want to bring wholeness to where there's brokenness. That's Judaism at its essence. Judaism is literally all about fixing the world. There's a concept called Tikkun Olam, which means fixing the world, literally, which is an ancient Jewish concept. It's talked a lot about in the mystical tradition. But also in the ethics and morals of Judaism, it shows up a lot, and it's really based on this idea that, you know, the world has a lot of brokenness in it, and we're here to fix it. We can use our free choice. We keep going back to that theme of free choice, that we can use our free choice, our free will, to fix it. But that's what we're supposed to do. And you know, in Judaism, I think the tools that we can use to help us not get burnt out, not get overwhelmed, one is faith. Right, like the person you mentioned before, faith is very strong in Judaism, and knowing that even if I see so much wrong in the world, first of all, and I'm going to get back to this in a second, there's so much beauty. There's so much beauty in the world as well, right? We can't forget that. We have to open up our eyes to the constant beauty of the world and the constant goodness. It's not all evil. It's not all broken. There's so much gorgeousness in this world, and it's all from God, and God created an incredible world, and we have to really remember that, one, for the sake of knowing that, you know, to recognize the goodness of this world, but also it helps us in terms of moving on. But coming back to the idea of faith, faith is very strong in Judaism, obviously, and it's the idea that, okay, you know what, this is how brokenness was built into the world. This is all from God, you know, and God wants us to do the work to fix it, and God's with me, right? God's giving me the strength. My strength comes from God, right? Like King David says in Psalms, I'll say it in Hebrew because it's so beautiful, and then I'll translate it into English. Right? I lift up my eyes to the mountain. Where does my help come from? Right? My help comes from God, makers of the heavens and the earth. Right? So constantly, literally, daily, constantly tapping into our faith. Right, and from that faith comes so much, including the strength to continue on, even in the face of challenge and brokenness. And the last thing I'll say just for now is that Judaism has built into it the celebration of life and the celebration of the beauty of the world. And that happens on a weekly level, a monthly level, and an annual level. Weekly is Shabbat. Every single week, every 7 days, we pause. We rest on Shabbat, on the Sabbath, not only to rest from our work, but also to create space to appreciate the goodness of the world and the beauty of the world. And the classic Jewish teaching is for 6 days of the week, we're doing our work. We're fixing the world, we're noticing, we're very aware of, even sometimes hyper aware of the brokenness, the challenges of our world. And on Shabbat, right, on some level, we stop being activists on Shabbat, right? Because now Shabbat is to fill myself back up, is to say, wow, what a world, what a gorgeous world. Give myself that rest. I'm not going to try to fix anything, right, either physically or figuratively. And I'm gonna tap into like, the holiness of this day. And that fills me up for another 6 days after that.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
To keep doing the work. And then I have another Shabbat. Wow. Again, amazing. I have a day of rest and I fill myself back up. Wow. And I go another 6 days. Right. And it's this incredible institution, if you want to call it that, of reconnecting ourselves, plugging ourselves back in. So that we have the physical and spiritual strength and ability to keep going on and not burning out. I feel like Shabbat at its core is all about not burning out physically and spiritually. And as an activist, that's a priceless, priceless tool.
You mentioned King David, and there's this recent TV series that was released on Prime Video. I don't know if you were aware of it. It's about King David, and I guess it's the first time I've watched something, you know, a Judaic story adapted to the movie format. This was, you know, the first time for me, you know, watching that. Did you watch it? No. too bad. I wish I had your feedback on that. But something interesting in that TV series I noticed as a vegan, of course, is, you know, they talk a lot about you know, animal sacrifices, and they do lots of animal sacrifices, but they never show, you know, the animal itself being sacrificed. You know, they always cut to the scene of here's the meat or whatever, the burnt sacrifice. And I found it very interesting that they would censor that part, you know, and not expose their audience to it. You know, they show armies battling with, you know, people dying left and right. But, you know, the sacrifice of the lamb, that they don't show. What do you make of that editing and how, you know, they perceive people to be more sensitive to showing a lamb being sacrificed to armies killing each other?
That is very interesting. I think it's a reflection of human society in our modern day world that people are disconnected from what really happens behind the scenes when they choose to eat animals, and they don't want to see that because they don't want to know, or they don't want to be reminded. Maybe they heard about it, saw something once or twice even, or three times, but they want to forget about it. And to be shown that is a reminder of, you know, even though that's in the context of, you know, ancient sacrifices, which we don't do anymore, it's still a reminder of, you know, it's intense to take an animal's life for your own personal needs, whether it's a sacrifice or for food, is an intense thing. And you should think about that. And you should be aware of that before you do it. And people don't want to do that. People just want to eat the steak or the hamburger and not think about what had to happen, you know, before that. And that's a problem. I met people in the past, you know, who, you know, they would only eat chicken if it was like in the form of like a patty, but no bones. So if they saw bones, they wouldn't be able to eat it. It's like, you know, and yeah, I think it is a reflection of the disconnect today and the real kind of like, don't tell me, I didn't see it, I don't know about it, I don't have to think about it, and then I can just keep doing whatever I want.
I'm sure there's a big Jewish audience, you know, watching that TV series. What is the state of, you know, progressive veganism in the Jewish community? I know that, you know, when I look at Buddhists, I wish there were more vegan Buddhists, and I feel strongly that this is the natural way to be a Buddhist, you know, being vegan. That there should be more vegan Buddhists than there are right now. Do you have the same feeling?
Yes, I do. I wish there were more Jewish vegans, and specifically, I wish there were more Orthodox Jewish vegans. As you might know, there's different kind of denominations in the Jewish world. The three main ones are Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. I'm part of the Orthodox Jewish community. And definitely, there's not that many Orthodox Jewish vegans out there, and I wish there were more for sure. And my, you know, long story short, I was always Jewish, but I didn't grow up religious. I grew up very secular, in a secular family and a secular lifestyle in America. I now live in Israel. As a result of a spiritual journey in college, I you know, searching, you know, for spiritual meaning and spiritual traditions, eventually that took me full circle to my own Jewish tradition, inspired actually by the environmental and animal welfare teachings that I discovered in Judaism at the age of 19 and 20, which nobody told me about. I was already at that point vegan. I went vegan when I went vegetarian when I was 18, vegan when I was 19. I'm now 49. So this fall, God willing, I'll be celebrating 30 years of being vegan. And I was an environmental studies major, and environmental movement was a big part of my life. And I never knew anything about Judaism and the environment or Judaism and animal welfare. And when I started to discover that, I'm like, really? Judaism has what to say about this? And that really opened up the door for me to explore more of my Jewish roots, eventually more of the spiritual tradition in Judaism. And that's when I really got interested and then started learning and took on an Orthodox traditional lifestyle. For me, Judaism supports veganism 100% in very strong and powerful ways. So for me, I see, I mean, dozens, if not hundreds, of sources in Judaism that support going vegan today because of the horrors of the factory farming world and the negative impact of eating an animal-based diet. So yeah, I see it as a very Jewish thing. Unfortunately, not that many, not enough Jews are vegan. More out of the Orthodox community, more of the most, if not all of the Jewish vegans that I know are not in the Orthodox community. A few of them are, but more in the conservative and reform, which are, you know, tend to be labeled as more kind of open to and interested in kind of like progressive movements and causes and the like. But you know, all of that is rooted in that concept I brought up before, tikkun olam, fixing the world. You know, so you know, it's so Jewish. It's so if I'm choosing the way that I eat because I care about the world and I want the world to be a better place, both for the planet and for all the creatures and creations living on this planet, that's tikkun olam, that's fixing the world. That's because I want this world to be a better place. So it's very Jewish, but still not enough Jews are choosing that path, in my opinion.
I want to know more about what you discovered exactly. I recently watched your teaching about that dairy holiday, and you can tell me more about it. And you were quoting that Jewish scholar who lived like a long time ago and was already, you know, thinking and preaching about, he was a rabbi. About vegetarianism and the suffering of animals, and I was really surprised, like positively surprised about his existence. And I was really not aware of that, you know, happening during that time. So, yeah, please tell me more.
So basically, Judaism is filled with laws and values and ethics and teachings. And within the laws of Judaism are laws that obligate us to show compassion for animals, obligate us. It's not a choice, it's not a suggestion, it's an obligation. There's laws on the books that you cannot cause unnecessary pain and suffering to animals, that you need to show compassion. We've been around for over 3,000 years, so we have lots of books. There's the book, the Torah, the five books of Moses, but then there's also all kinds of commentaries and other books and anything from Jewish law to Jewish mysticism and Jewish philosophy and everything in between. And so many Jewish rabbis, leaders, and writers have talked about throughout the generations about this, about compassion for animals, right? That one very famous one, his name is Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, who lived 500 years ago in Israel. He wrote about that if someone disparages, if someone shows disrespect to an animal, what they're really doing is disrespecting God, because God created that animal, right? Which is a very powerful teaching. The class that you were referring to specifically about the holiday we recently had called Shavuot, which is a holiday that we commemorate and celebrate the giving of the Torah Mount Sinai over 3,000 years ago, eventually it became known as like the dairy holiday. It's not an obligation to eat dairy, but because Torah is compared to milk, for various reasons, one, because milk gives life to newborn animals, so too Torah gives life. So there's no obligation whatsoever to eat dairy on Shavuot, but it became a custom. Judaism, like other traditions, is filled with customs as well, not obligations, but customs, which is a beautiful thing. Customs are beautiful, traditions. But when a tradition gets in the way of an obligation, in this case, eating dairy, which causes incredible and immense pain and suffering, both physically and emotional, to God's creatures, to eat those foods on a holiday that celebrates the giving of the Torah by God makes no sense whatsoever. We're celebrating, our tradition through causing pain and suffering to God's creatures. That just doesn't make sense. So the rabbi whose teaching I shared in that class, his name is Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Kook. He lived from 1865 to 1935, and he was a very, very holy visionary of a man. We don't have prophets these days anymore, but if we did, he would be included in them. He really saw the world in a very different way, and he wrote quite a lot. He wrote a lot in general, but included in his teachings, he wrote about animal welfare and about eating animals and how the original diet that was given to humanity in the Garden of Eden through Adam and Eve, which was a purely plant-based diet, as it says in chapter 1 of Genesis, verse 29, that was the ideal, that was the ideal, and that one day we're meant to return to that ideal. And so he wrote about that. He brought it into his own life, he was one of the few rabbinic leaders to really talk about it in such a direct way.
When you talk to Jews about all of that, what is their first reaction?
I get a lot of pushback, a lot of pushback. Specifically, with all due love and respect to my fellow Orthodox Jews, especially from Orthodox Jews, they say a lot of the things that they say are the same things I've heard from many people many times. Well, God let us eat animals, so there's no problem. It's kosher. That's all I care about. That's all I have to care about is that it's kosher. My rabbi does it. That means I can do it. My rabbi eats it, so I can eat it. These are classic kind of responses. And I always have my answers that I share back with them. It's very much kind of rooted in like, I'm allowed to, so I do. Right? God let us eat animals, so I do. So don't tell me I can't or I shouldn't. And my response almost always is, it's yes, obviously, God gave us permission, right? Like we just said that God gave a purely plant-based diet in the Garden of Eden that lasted until the generation of the flood and the generation of Noah, after which, after the flood, God then changed the diet and allowed humans to eat animals. The main word there is allowed, not obligated them. And so I always share back with them. It's like, yes, we do have the permission. Clearly, Judaism allows us to kill animals for food, right? In a very specific way, something called shechita, which is kosher slaughter. But we're allowed to. We're allowed to for sure. But if we're doing that in a way that's going against other obligations of the Torah, like not causing pain and suffering to animals, so what are we doing? We're doing something that's, you know, permissible, but in the process, we're breaking a law that's an obligation. So how do you justify that? I don't really usually ever hear a good answer to that question, I'll be honest with you.
You mentioned that this work of confronting people and convincing them to become vegan and care about animals, you consider that holy. What did you mean by that?
Good question. I think it's connected to something you guys said before, is that of all the things that we do as humans, I really believe that our food choices, what we eat, has the greatest impact in so many different ways on the world, on the planet, on creation. Right? What I eat will impact the earth. It will impact the soil, the water, the atmosphere. It'll impact other humans, right? It'll impact other creatures, of course. It'll impact my health. It'll impact my family. It's pervasive. It's one of the few things that we do in our lives that has such a diverse and wide-reaching impact. And so when in addition to that, we have desires for good tasting things and ta'avot, as we call them in Hebrew, like lusts and desires. And it's not always easy to hold ourselves back and to not give in to them, especially if they're permissible, right? I'm allowed to eat a steak. I'm allowed to eat burgers, right? I'm allowed to have a barbecue with meat hot dogs and the like. And when we overcome that desire for the sake of a value, that takes a lot of strength. That takes a lot of self-discipline. And when that action of ours, when that change is for the sake of creating a better world, which is the ultimate mission and vision of Judaism, that's holy. That's holy, right? You're sanctifying life. What does it mean, holy, right? In Judaism, something that's holy is something that's been sanctified. Why is Shabbat holy? Because it's been sanctified, right? It's being elevated. And we're supposed to do the same thing with the world. We're supposed to sanctify this world. We're supposed to make this world a dwelling place for holiness, for godliness. And when we choose actions for the sake of that, with that in mind, with that intention, in order to make this world a more godly place, that's holy work.
Do you feel like the vegan community is investing enough in supporting religious, not movements, but organizations, activists? Because I feel like the best argument we can make for people to become vegans is a religious argument. I think that to make real change in this world, we have to focus on the religious aspect of, you know, this whole equation. I feel like we focus too much on the economic aspect of it. And I see, you know, lots of street activists and so on making the ethical argument for veganism. But then, like you mentioned before, if I take my moral ethical cues from my rabbi, who are you to tell me, you know, what is ethical or not? Of course, we are all capable of, you know, being independent in our thoughts and mind, but there are people we consider moral authorities in our life. And so why aren't we doing more to reach those people, to support those, you know, rabbi, imam, Buddhist monks and priests that make the argument for veganism?
Another very good question. I think that a lot of people, I think we clearly see it in our world today. A lot of people are turned off to religion. People, even though I think we religious people see, you know, the real beauty and even purity of religion, we're still human beings. And not everyone who is quote unquote religious or a member of a certain religious path and community lives up to the values and the highest values of that religious community and path. And I think people today, a lot of people are turned off to religion and by religion because they see it as something that has been corrupted, and they see a lot of corruption in religions. And even though that's not the essence of religion, that's human error on the part of religious people. They kind of, you know, put it all together and they throw out religion. So I think there's a weakened interest in religion in general in our society today. And even if, you know, you were to target the people who are connected to religion, they often use those same arguments. It's like, God created us as higher than animals. We're allowed to use anything we want in this world. We're better than the animals. So I don't have to think about this stuff. So don't tell me that I have to. And they have their own religious arguments, you know, against our religious arguments. So it makes it very challenging in that sense. But I think it's easier for most activists today to, hold on to the ethical arguments, and not the religious arguments, though in my eyes, they're one and the same. Where do ethics come from? Ethics are rooted in these religious traditions. But yeah. And I'll be honest with you, I think there's not that many like religious vegans out there. There's not enough for them to be known about, seen, heard. And so therefore their time, energy, and resources are going to be invested elsewhere.
Yeah, I'm thinking more and more, you know, what are we doing creating fake meat in laboratory when there's this whole lane of, you know, developing the religious argument for veganism that it is, you know, unexploited and pretty much neglected. And, you know, all the resources and funding goes to playing Dr. Frankenstein with, you know, lab-grown meat.
Yeah, I agree. I'm totally on that page with you. I find it so interesting. You know, the way I look at it, at least, is God created a world filled with food, filled with a diversity of colorful and beautiful and nourishing and delicious food. Why are we going into a laboratory, investing tons of money and tons of energy and resources, right? This is an energy intensive process that they're trying to, you know, perfect for the market. It's like, why are we doing, we can take all that money and put it into education, into outreach, into all kinds of things. And, you know, we don't need that. I can get my health and nutrition from things that are already just simply growing in the world. I'm also a little bit confused by it.
Yeah, I used to look at this lab-grown meat as, you know, using religious terminology, the Messiah. You know, I was thinking, this will come, this will be developed, and then it will be the end of animal exploitation. And nowadays, I'm thinking more and more that it won't, for many different reasons. And I don't think that. I think that this fight is a religious fight. This fight is a cultural fight. This fight is a psychological fight, societal fight, not an economic one. We won't make changes. We will make, and there has been, you know, tremendous changes on that front, but caused by, you know, economic pressure. But it won't resolve the problem, you know. But yeah, that's my opinion. Okay, let's talk about anti-Semitism. I think we cannot just, you know, have a conversation about Judaism and you know, forget about this, go over it. I did an episode on anti-Semitism in the vegan community, And I was thinking of you and how this must complicate your work in reaching out to Jews, because, you know, you're trying to make the religious argument for veganism, and you're trying to influence Jews to adopt a vegan lifestyle. But then they look at the vegan community, and there isn't, you know, a welcome party, you know, waiting for them. Quite the opposite. So this must really complicate your work.
Very much so. Very much so. Already before October 7th, 2023, and way more since. I remember years ago, I wrote this little booklet about Judaism and the environment, and included in that was about animal welfare and our food choices. And I tried to put it, I tried to get into religious bookstores in New York. And the first store I went to, the first thing that the book owner said is like, oh, is that that PETA stuff? I saw their advertisement comparing, you know, animal suffering to Holocaust, you know, victims. That was horrible, right? So right away, you know, there was this negative kind of perspective on the movement. You know, how dare they take something that's so sensitive to us Jews and use it in their campaigns, right? That was years ago. That was like 25 years ago, if not more. But more recently, you know, more and more activists have been showing up and doing protests at something you might be familiar with, something called Kapparot, which is a ritual that Jews do before Yom Kippur, which is all about asking God for forgiveness. Most of the Jewish world does it with money that then gets given to those who need it. Some, a minority, but unfortunately enough, in the ultra-Orthodox community, do it with chickens, live chickens, and they wave them around their head, and then they slaughter them right there on the spot, and it's a whole mess. It's a horrible, horrible mess, and me as a Jew, I'm totally against it, and many Jews are against it. They can still continue to do it, but what happens is that oftentimes, you know, non-Jewish animal welfare activists will show up at these places, and they just start screaming at them, and they start, you know, being so offensive to them. And so these Orthodox Jews see them as like the representation of the animal welfare movement and the vegan movement. And they're just like, see, look how they act. Look what they're doing to us. This is anti-Semitic. They're coming out here and they're getting involved with our religious rituals and things like that. So that's just another example, which has been a big turnoff, at least in the Orthodox world. But by far the greatest damage to Jewish vegans and the general vegan world and movement has been post October 7th. I've talked to countless Jewish vegetarians and vegans since then, and they've just told me how they've been ostracized by their vegan community. Many of these Jewish vegans, their vegan community was a bigger part of their life than their Jewish community was, right? Their veganism is so important to them that it was their vegan community that they went to for gatherings and for events and social connections. And then post October 7th, they see their vegan friends posting all kinds of horrible stuff about Israel. And there's always that fine line between, you know, criticism of Israel, anti-Israel and anti-Semitism. And these people are, you know, these people are good people, you know, really open people wanting to make the world a better place. And they just felt completely, I mean, on some level, people would say to me like, I don't know, saying duped is a harsh and hard word, but they felt really almost tricked, traumatized by the hate that was coming out of their fellow members of their vegan community. And they lost it all. Many of these people lost it all. They either they were kind of like pushed out or had to leave literally for their mental health. And it was very, very traumatic. And I've talked to many people about a month or two into the war. I opened up a Zoom webinar, for free for people just to join. Dozens and dozens of Jewish vegans came on, and everyone said the same thing. Everyone talked about the same thing. This person, I know them for 15 years. We've been so close in the vegan community. We've done such great work together. And now I see what they're saying, what they're sharing, what they're posting. It's like, it's horrible. It's traumatic. So yeah, anti-Semitism in the vegan community has been felt tremendously since October 7th. And it's caused a lot of Jewish vegans to go inner. And I'll be honest with you, it's very unfortunate to lose trust in the general vegan world. Obviously, it's not everyone, but it's been enough people and enough times that they feel like they're not sure if those connections can ever be rebuilt. And I guess you can say the silver lining of that, the benefit of that, is that the Jewish vegan community has gone really much more inner and stronger as a result. And our kind of inner ties and connections have become much stronger. And I become connected to people, other Jewish vegans who maybe I wouldn't have as a result of the anti-Semitism that has come out since October 7th. So it's unfortunate, it's real, it's there, it's visible and it's felt. And yeah, it's sad to say, but I don't know if it's repairable. I think this might be, a one and done thing that Jewish vegans are not going to look back to even try to repair that, because it's been so hurtful and so damaging.
Yeah, that was my next question. What is the solution to that? And is there a path to, reuniting and having a more, I guess, healthier unity in the vegan movement? Is there a way to, forgive, not forget, but to amend those offenses and have a new united front on in terms of pro-animal movement? Or is the solution, or is the path forward to create new organizations this time that will not reflect those anti-Semitic positions? So what is it?
I think it's continuing separately, doing the similar work but doing it separately, doing it within a Jewish context with other Jews. That's a safe space. It's a safer space. It's a supportive space. And just too many people have seen too many things and heard too many things, I think, to ever really, kind of go back. Of course, that's not everybody, but I think it's enough people. And I've heard it so many times. I mean, myself, we've all, those of us in the Jewish vegan world, we've seen it so many times. Like big vegan influencers, they start wearing the keffiyeh and saying all kinds of anti-Israel stuff, and when their whole page was just about like vegan food, all of a sudden it's about politics now, and they're bringing up Israel, and they're saying this about Israel and that about Israel, and it's a big turnoff. I've When at the beginning of the war, my vegan rabbi social media page up until October 7th, 2023, I only talked about veganism. I never talked about anything else on it on purpose. And then after, October 7th, like I had to talk about Israel. I had to, talk about what's going on. And I lost tons of followers. I lost probably hundreds of followers, got all kinds of horrible either comments or messages. Every now and then I still get them. But what I also saw is all these influencers using their platforms and their pages to spew a lot of hate against Israel, against the Jewish people. And that was, oh, I mean, people I really, really liked and really looked up to. I had to unfollow them because I couldn't see it anymore. There's this one, I won't say his name, but there's this one vegan chef. He's got like, I think like a million followers on Instagram. And all of a sudden he's like showing up with a keffiyeh and saying all this stuff. Like, who are you? Like, what do you even know? What did you even know about any of this before October 7th? So you watch a few TikTok videos and now you think you know everything. And it's disturbing. It's very disturbing. So it's very painful. And I'm not sure in our generation, that there's going to be much healing there. So we're just continuing our work, on our own, and doing it together in our way.
You mentioned comparisons to the Holocaust. Now, I believe that what Peter did with that Holocaust campaign was in pretty bad taste, and that is a euphemism. But at the same time, there is work, you know. For instance, the book An Eternal Treblinka, and you know, there is the fact that you can, or at least, you know, I've done it, and other activists have done it, to say, you know, there is a animal Holocaust. You know, I'm not going to put pictures of Holocaust victims in front of, but, you know, just saying it. Do you think that also is offensive to the Jewish community? And, you know, what do you make of the book, An Eternal Treblinka, if you know about it?
I'm aware of it, yeah. It's interesting. I 100% understand why Jews take offense to it. Without a doubt, I get it. You know, the Holocaust is still very, you know, recent in Jewish history. Just about 80 years since the end of World War II and the end of the Holocaust. Many of us have family members, you know, none that we've met, obviously, but that we've been told about, that were murdered in the Holocaust. My own family on my mother's side, her parents were from Poland. They got out before the war, but more than half of their families were murdered in the Holocaust. So, like, we grew up with this stuff. Like, we grew up with the Holocaust, like, fresh in our minds. So I get why Jews have that reaction, and I think they're 100% right. I personally, as a vegan, I get it. I get the comparison, because from the perspective of the animals, this is very controversial, what I'm about to say. It's worse than the Holocaust. The numbers, you know, are far greater, like you said at the beginning. You know, we're not talking about millions, we're talking about billions. And that takes nothing away from the tragedy and the horrors of the Holocaust. It takes nothing away from that. But at the same time, when we look at reality from the perspective of the animals going through the factory farming world, it is an absolute Holocaust. From the day that they're forced to be born to the day that they're forced to be killed. So I do agree that it's a Holocaust from their perspective, on a magnitude that we can't even imagine. And so I personally do not find offense in the comparison. I don't really talk about that opinion of mine, because almost even other Jewish vegans that I'm connected to, they do take offense to it. And I understand that and I respect it. So I think I'm a minority opinion on that. But I think if we understood what's going on in the factory farming world and what these animals are going through from their perspective, what they're going through, that maybe we'd have a higher chance of people opening up their hearts and making changes. So I get PETA's tactics. I get their, like, in your face, intense, like, because it's real. It is intense. It is actually happening every single second. So I actually understand them, why they did that.
Do you think that we should be, at a certain level, comfortable with offending people in our activism?
Yes, I do. People have to be shaken out of their comfort zones. And there's lots of causes. There's lots of issues. I'm sure there's causes and issues that I need to be shaken out of my comfort zone, for sure, right? I'm sure, you know, people can come up to me and say things about my lifestyle choices, where I buy my clothing from. You know, I don't buy all, like, you know, sensitive and aware and conscious and organic and handmade clothing. I know my clothing comes from factories, and that's a real problem. So, you know, I'm not perfect. None of us are perfect. We live in a very problematic world in terms of striving for perfection in our lifestyle choices. And I'm aware of that. But yes, I think people need to be shocked sometimes, not all the time, because then you'll lose them. But I think shock activism is proper in the right measure, at the right time, and in the right way. Because people, you know, sometimes I might be, like, you know, on my phone and I'm on Instagram, and I see, you know, half of the things I see on Instagram have to do with veganism, just because of the algorithm. And so I'll see a video or a picture of animal suffering. And if someone's next to me who eats animals. I'll show them that. And right away, they get like freaked out. Why did you show that to me? I'm like, hello, this is what you eat. You know, what are you talking about? So I think there's absolutely space for that. We need a multi kind of multifaceted approach, but I think that's one that it's important to use, again, in the right way and in the right measure at the right time.
You said you're based in Israel. What is the state of animal welfare and animal rights in Israel?
Horrible, just like most other places. There is a relatively large vegan and vegetarian community here. You know, statistics come out and say that Israel per capita is one of the most vegan countries in the world, which is really nice to know. And about 5% of the population is vegan. If you include vegetarians, it goes up to 13%, which is pretty high. But at the same time, it's a meat-heavy society, and animals here are treated just as poorly as in other places. So unfortunately, you know, not much good to share when it comes to that. I feel like in Israel, but I think this is happening globally as well, like the vegan movement is growing, awareness is growing, but at the same time, the pace at which people eat animals is not slowing down. It's if anything, it's kind of growing. And so I feel like these two movements are growing simultaneously and parallel to each other. So it's nice to see the vegan, you know, expansion in Israel, but it's upsetting to see what's happening in the animal agriculture world, that it's not very enlightened and it's just as bad as other places.
5% is a gigantic voting bloc. Why aren't we seeing more, pro-animal progress reflected in Israeli politics? Or are we, that I'm not aware of?
It's a very good question. I'll say two things. One, there have been successes along the way in terms of animal rights and animal welfare in Israel. Certain things having to do with fur and certain kind of animal, I hate saying the word animal products, but, you know, food that comes from animals, food products that come from animals, live transports. I believe, if I remember correctly, there was a law that was recently passed that by a certain year in the not far future that will be banned in Israel. I have to look that up again to make sure that that's correct. But I remember seeing that. But it's an interesting question you're asking, because as you can imagine, politics here in Israel are very different than politics elsewhere, because we're dealing with so many security issues. And politics here are very security driven. And so it's not, you know, like in other places where, you know, there's all these, you know, you're voting for someone because of what they say about the environment and what they say about this cause and that cause. It's like literally on some level, especially during wartime, it's like a single issue political climate. It's like, what are you going to do for security? Like, we're constantly, you know, facing real intense security challenges. So what are you going to do to make the country stronger and ensure our survival? So because of that, other issues get a back burner. And while there are members of the Israeli parliament that do care about these issues and do push forward legislation, that does happen. I know a couple of politicians over the last few years who are, you know, members of the Knesset who were vegan, which was amazing. But still, it's you know, kind of the doesn't get spoken about very much. It's really about, again, you know, how you're gonna fight our enemies in the most effective way possible, and it's really kind of takes up most of the space here politically.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Is it? Sorry for being unfamiliar, but is it a proportional democracy system in Israel? Is there, you know, place for smaller parties to win, positions in the government, or even elect MPs in the Knesset or something like that?
There is on paper, yes, absolutely. It's not a two-party system, it's a multi-party system. It's dozens of parties. When you go to vote here in Israel, you literally see dozens of choices, which on one level is great, but most of them never pass the threshold, so it's kind of pointless. Doesn't really have an impact. And still, it's usually the same kind of seven or eight political parties that make it through, and then they're the ones who have to kind of scramble around to make a coalition. Right, the winning party gets the first chance to make a coalition. If they do, great. If not, then the second one gets to, and the second place is usually, the opposition to the leading political party. But it does create space, and there are, political organizations based on all kinds of issues, single issues as a result. But again, the problem is that they don't make it through the threshold, so they don't have the impact that they're seeking, and they're never ever involved in the coalition if they even get through the threshold, which they usually don't, because they have to get a certain number of votes to get into the parliament. So a lot of people look at it as wasted votes, even if they care about that single issue. They're like, I'm not going to vote because they're not going to get through. I'd rather give my vote to this party who I believe in how they're going to approach security issues. It always goes back to that. So it is very democratic. In that sense, but in the end, when the coalition is actually built, it's there's not a lot of, if any, of these single issue parties represented.
Yeah, I'm asking that because the bet here in Canada is to get proportional democratic system in order to get power for pro-animal party and make more progress. Listeners will understand. I've had many conversations about that. Mostly with Liz White, who's the incredible leader of the Animal Protection Party of Canada. Okay, I want to end the conversation, Rabbi, with something else you're specialized in, which is matchmaking. And I want to hear how you got into that and, what is your rate of success, and maybe if you have, stories to share about, happy stories about that, I would love to hear them.
Great. Yeah. So I never thought I'd get into matchmaking through my vegan rabbi work. The platform I started about 4 years ago. I've been doing Jewish environmental education for over 20 years, and within that, again, focus on animal welfare and veganism. But really, with the creation of Vegan Rabbi, it was definitely the most focused work and outreach that I've done in my whole life. And it's become a big part of my life and a growing part of my life. And already within the first year of creating Vegan Rabbi, singles who are in my network, followers of mine on social media, they got started getting in touch with me one after the other, asking, "Hey, I'm Jewish, vegan, single, looking for somebody. Do you happen to know anyone? Can you help me?" And at first, I'm like, "What do I know about any of this? I'm not a matchmaker. I'm not, And then I just kept hearing from people. I'm like, "Wait a minute, there's something happening here, right?" The Jewish world is very much focused on matchmaking, but maybe there's nothing specifically for Jewish vegan vegetarian singles. And I did some scouring around the internet, found nothing, and I decided I'm going to do something. I have no background, no experience, but I'm going to try. And I built a database and I invited people to join it. And shortly after that, a friend of mine built like a free matchmaking website. So I kind of uploaded my database members to his platform, and then shortly after that, I met a woman named Eliza Ben Shalom, who was the star of the Netflix show Jewish Matchmaking. She had recently moved to the town I live in Israel, and I told her this was before the Netflix show came out, but I knew she was a matchmaker, and I told her about what I was starting to get into. She's like, "Wow, we should talk." And I told her about what I was doing. She actually used to be vegan, interestingly enough. She's no longer now, but I told her what I was doing, and she invited me to train with her. I'm like, "Wow, I get to like train with this, top matchmaker. That's amazing." So I did a whole training with her, and then she invited me to join her team and her staff, which I did for over a year and a half. I recently left a couple months ago, but basically that was just incredible experience learning the ins and outs of the world of matchmaking and dating coaching. And that's become a part of my life as well. And so, you know, specifically since leaving working with her, I've been kind of like investing my energies more again in my niche in the Jewish matchmaking world for Jewish vegan, vegetarian singles. I have a whole network of hundreds and hundreds of people. And people reach out to me, they heard about me, they get my number from somebody, they tell me their story, they share their bio and ask if I know of anybody. So, you know, I have lots of people in my network, lots of people I keep in mind. And then there's some people I work with, like actually like in a very official one-on-one way in terms of whether it's dating coaching or full-on matchmaking. It's an ancient Jewish art, Jewish matchmaking. And, you know, it's really based on these values that we're talking about. And I understand it because I was in the same place many, many years ago when I was dating and looking, you know, to meet someone and looking to get married, that I wanted to, one of the top, if not the top things on my list that was so important to me is that someone who shares this lifestyle with me, shares these food choices and lifestyle choices with me and these, you know, the concern for the environment, for animal welfare. That was very, very top of the list for me. And I met, you know, different women, different great women, but not always did they share that passion and that compassion until I did, and that was my wife. And so the singles who I'm connected to with now or work with, I very much understand where they're coming from. Because again, I went through that. I was in that same place many years ago. And just for me, it's just, you know, to bring two people together is an incredible thing in and of itself. And to bring two, you know, people with shared values about the environment and about the animal welfare and about human health and protection of our world is even, for me, even greater. So it's, you know, to be able to help two people come together who will then build a home based on those values and raise children with those values. It's just, you know, talk about trying to change the world. It's one of the ways, you know, to make the world a better place.
I know I said, you know, last question, but I lied.
I do the same thing.
So you mentioned shared values. We often hear about chemistry, you know, how important it is to have chemistry. But I feel not enough about shared values. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, look, you know, I talk to all kinds of people. I'm in touch with vegan singles or have been or currently am who, like, I can only date a vegan. There's no way, you know. And then I know vegan singles who are like, you know, ideally she's vegan, but if she's vegetarian, that's fine as well. And even people like, you know what, I'm very open, you know, as long as, you know, we match up in other ways and hopefully she'll come towards my side, you know, or vice versa, like a girl talking about a guy. So I meet all kinds of people, right? But yeah, you know, for the majority of them, the shared value aspect is very, very important. And they're just like, I don't want to open up my fridge and see, you know, see chicken and steak and all these different things. And it's really, really important to them. And they want their kitchen to be a reflection of their values and they want their spouse to also share in that. So it's really, really important. Shared values is just so important in terms of relationships and marriage in general. But especially for vegans and vegetarians, right, who have made very specific choices in their life, and their lives and their lifestyles reflect that, when it comes to finding someone to spend, God willing, the rest of their life with, this is just of very, very high importance and will help. It's not a guarantee, but it will definitely help to strengthen the bonds between them and to maintain the strength of their bonds.
I want to ask more questions because we're going to actually record a special episode just about that, with also, you know, vegan activist couples who will be participating in this group conversation. I'm really looking forward to having that conversation because every time I open social media, I feel like it's one of the top issues. People asking questions or commenting about how it is tough to find someone who's vegan, or, you know, being in a relationship with someone who's not vegan comes with a whole lot of, you know, troubles. And You know, I feel people need help navigating the dating world, at least vegans. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that conversation.
Same here. It's a great conversation to have. Looking forward as well.
Wonderful. So, Rabbi, did you have anything to add before I stop the recording?
First of all, I'll just say thank you so much for this opportunity to speak with you and about this very important topic. Really a pleasure and an honor. And just really to sum up, you know, kind of like what we were focusing on before, that, you know, I think a lot of people today look at veganism as extreme and vegans as extreme. But really, when you look at the root of it all, it's like we're just trying to be like nice people. We're trying to be the best people that we can be and try to create the best world we can create. It's really so much about such a basic value of creating a better world, of more goodness in the world. Like, who doesn't want less pain and suffering in the world? You know, who doesn't want more health in the world? Who doesn't want more wholeness and wellness in the world? That's what it's all about, right? I think it's important for people to know that. And I think it's important for us vegans to kind of broadcast that and share that in our messaging so people can really understand where we're coming from and why we're doing this work.
Wonderful, great parting words. Again, Rabbi Akiva, thank you so much for your time and for answering my questions. Thank you everyone for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.